Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to see this today. We're going to talk about how fruits and vegetables are the latest superpower. What do they do? Well, the University of Southern California is giving us some answers, and it's good. And then we're going to look at curcumin again, because there's new research showing how this extremely powerful spice fight a particular illness that everyone's afraid of. University of Paris is giving us some insights on that. And then deep sleep, where you're not dreaming. According to University of California, Berkeley, that is a fountain of youth, especially as you're getting older. And a lot more on health and healing today. From our audiophile, we'll be hearing about why we should not jump to conclusions and automatically trust that the latest chemical attack was done by Assad. Now, you wouldn't know that it was not Assad from Nikki Haley, who is our ambassador to the UN, who immediately attacked Assad, or Donald Trump and the people around him saying, well, now we've got to do something. And all the neocons saying yes, and the New York Times, of course, without exception, saying yes, it's got to be Assad. What if it's not Assad? What if they're all wrong? What if it was a false flag? Yesterday, I gave you more than two dozen actual examples of false flags that our government did that led us into the war in Vietnam, which caused 3.5 million Vietnamese to die, more than 2 million American soldiers to be exposed to the defoliant 245T or dioxin and Agent Orange, and also 50,000 dead and over 200,000 injured. No one apologized. No one was held accountable. Many other false flags. What if not a false, just a false flag? Because they're just about to go into a peace conference, and Assad's thing, been no motivation. Also, he had no sarin gas. But guess who did have sarin gas? You guessed it, Al Nusra, the rebels, the ones we've been supporting. Ron Paul will be talking about the sarin gas attack today, and I have two other commentaries I'll be giving you on it also. One on the sarin gas attack from Al-Masra News from Paul Ananopoulos. Also another one, Donald Trump's war crimes from Truth Out from Marjorie Cohen. Also, U.S. military should get out of the Middle East. And Countdown to Disaster, David Rosen from the Boston Globe. No, excuse me, Jeffrey. Yeah, that's right, Globe. So we're talking about the conflicts we're in, but also today, we're going to talk about ending the reserve. Boy, this is the biggest financial scam in history. And you're going to have a seven-minute education on the Federal Reserve. Not know, but it's going to be important to you. Also, recently, the United States told Cambodia $1 billion. Really? Well, let me see. Wasn't it the United States, Henry Kissinger's, who's still alive, Richard Nixon, who came up with the idea of secretly bombing Cambodia because Cambodia was being used, at least one part of Cambodia, by the Vietnam, North Vietnamese, to transport their soldiers into South Vietnam. And how many did we kill? Well, estimates start at 5,000 innocent civilians. And in fact, a tremendous amount of bombs in Cambodia. And reparations, no apologies. Also, because of our bombing, because of our destruction, Rouge and Pol Pot and the killing fields and 2 million of Cambodia's intellects, educators, were killed. All that because of the United States. And if what we did in Cambodia, we created an ISIS-type organization in Cambodia, headed by an absolutely homicidal maniac that we refused to bring to justice later when we could. spot. And then we'll also take a look at a lot of other information involving Donald Trump's mental state. Now, once we get into these commentaries, I'm inviting you to call in and share your points of view. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. Also, yesterday we set a new record for the number of people listening live on the telephone. And let me give you that number out again, Monday to Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time. If you want to hear the program on any listening device or any telephone, you can call 701-801-3662, 701-801-3662. But if you can't listen live and you want to listen to it at some other time, you can. You can download up to 5 programs for free. Call this number, 701-719-9976. That's our archive listen number, 701-719-9976. But if you're at a computer, you can just go to the computer and download it from there. So you see, we have one packed show. So we're going to begin always with the latest on health, and because people want to live lives, and we're going to help them get there. First up, we know we should be eating more fruits and vegetables. Good. How much more? It's a matter of juicing, ideally 3 glasses of fresh vegetable or fruit juice a day. And there are various combinations, but with the vegetable juice, always start with cucumber and celery. Both are incredibly healing, and they lower blood pressure, and they lower cholesterol, and they help speed up digestion, and they alleviate constipation, and they help reduce swelling, especially edema in the ankles and the legs. But then add in specific darker greens like watercress, arugula, collard greens, bok choy, kale. All those are fine. Fruits, one of the best combinations of fruit juice you could have is watermelon and lemon juice. That would be the juice of 2 lemons and watermelon. Another great juice would be grapefruit and green apple. Very purifying, very healing. But if you're the average American, you're lucky just to eat 1 to 2 servings of vegetables or fruits a day. But here's the latest in the University of Southern California. They're talking about the potassium, because your heart benefits from potassium. Your heart does not benefit from sodium. Sweet potatoes, avocados, spinach, beans, bananas, all of those can lower your blood pressure. They're rich in potassium, and they help decrease sodium. Quote, decreasing sodium intake is a well-established way to lower blood pressure, but evidence suggests that increasing dietary potassium may have an equally important effect on hypertension, end quote. And that was from the person heading this study, the Professor Alicia McDonough, Professor of Neurological Biology at the School of Medicine. So, simple, increase the amount of fruits and vegetables and have less heart attack and less stroke. In fact, the World Health Organization estimates that hypertension is responsible for at least 50% of all the deaths due to stroke and heart attacks. This was published in the American Journal of Physiology, Endocrinology, and Metabolism. Now, I mentioned yesterday why curcumin was so important. There's over 1,000 studies on curcumin as an anti-inflammatory and over 700 on cancer-fighting capacity. Well, it does something else, according to the University of Paris. Published in Antiviral Research, the article appearing in the next month, shows that curcumin, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, it's the compound in the spice turmeric, acts against Zika and other viruses that are mosquito-borne. Quote, the devastating effects of the Chikungunya virus as it spread from Africa to Southeast Asia to the Americas were an ominous warning for the potential spread of relatively unknown viruses worldwide. The clinical symptoms of the virus range from asymptomatic cases to long-term arthritis, which is debilitating. When Zika virus began to spread again from Africa to Southeast Asia to Americas, the impact of the virus was similarly devastating, especially given the newly observed links between the virus and neurological conditions and microcephaly. The persistent threat of viruses such as these two necessitate measures, including the development of repurposing of antiviral approaches to prepare outbreaks, end quote. Well, here's what happened. Cells were pre-treated with curcumin, and they found that it had an enormously protective effect. In fact, curcumin was more effective when administered prior to or at the time of infection than after infection. And the compound, when directly administered to the viruses, infectivity. So that is important. So, curcumin, one more in our diet. Also, one reason to get a good night's sleep. According to University of California, a review of the sleep research finds that restorative, sedative-free slumber can ward off mental and physical ailments. Let me put this in a way that we can all appreciate. As we grow older, our nights are frequently plagued by bouts of wakefulness, bathroom trips, and other nuisances as we lose our ability to generate the deep, restorative slumber we enjoyed in youth. But does that mean older people just need less sleep? Not according to University of Berkeley researchers, who argue in an article published this week in the journal Neuron that the unmet sleep needs of the elderly elevate the risk of memory loss and a wide range of mental and physical disorders. Quote, nearly every disease in later life a causal link to a lack of sleep. That's according to the senior author, a Berkeley professor of physiology and psychology and neuroscience. Quote, we've done a good job of extending lifespan, but a poor job of extending health span. We now see sleep and improving sleep as a new pathway. That's important. Because unlike more cosmetic markers, aging, such as wrinkles and gray hair, sleep deterioration has been linked to Alzheimer's, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, and stroke. And though age over the age of 40, people are less likely than younger cohorts to notice any or report on mental fatigue and other symptoms of sleep deprivation, numerous brain studies reveal how poor sleep leaves them cognitively worse off. Moreover, the shift from deep, consolidated sleep in youth to fitful, dissatisfying sleep can as early as in your early 30s, paving the way for sleep-related cognitive and physical ailments in middle age. So all the more reason to get a good night's sleep. Now, what are some of the ways that we can get a good night's sleep? Well, one way is that we can turn off all the lights, and if they're still in at all, because that's going to impact us, we simply put an eye patch, a soft satin or silk eye patch on, and so we have no vision at all, because if you can see any light, light will interrupt the brain and melatonin secretion from the pineal gland. Sound as well. If you have no sound in the room, great. If you have sound, not good, use earplugs. And don't allow any electromagnetic pulses near your head within 8 feet. That means cell phones, digital clocks, digital television. Don't have them within 8 feet. And then don't drink a liquid within an hour of going to bed, because then you might have 2 or 3 times to empty your bladder. So simple things like that. And also, on an upcoming program, I'll give you a protocol for getting a better night's sleep. From New York Presbyterian Hospital and Weill Cornell Medical Center, if you are deficient in vitamin D. That's an indicator of heart disease in overweight children. Now, right now, we have an absolutely pandemic of disease in children. We have arthritis, we have obesity, we have heart disease in children in their 8, 10, 12, 14 years of age. We've never had this before. But one of the indicators is if you're deficient in vitamin D, that also can cause a marked increase in heart cardiovascular disease, especially if the child is overweight. And this was presented at the annual meeting of the Endocrine Society. So we need our sunshine vitamin, and we need it daily. Quote from the study, "These findings suggest that vitamin D deficiency may have negative effects on specific lipid markers with an increase in cardiovascular risk among children and adolescents." So if you can't get vitamin D, then get a supplement of 2,000 to 3,000 units a day. And finally, from Brigham and Women's Hospital, we know that a lot of factors can contribute to how fast an organism ages. For example, a bad diet, weak genetics, being in a toxic environment. All of these interventions can influence and shorten your lifespan. But in order to understand how each factor influences aging and which ones slow its progression, researchers need an accurate biomarker, in effect a clock that distinguishes between chronological and biological age. Remember, I've said many times on this program, you're really two ages. For, you know, just as a cursory indicator, you're a chronological age. You are 50, 73, 84, 22. But that's irrelevant. It's your biological age that's relevant. And that's how the age of your biology is determining how long you're going to live and what health you will as long as you live. Now, a traditional clock can measure the passage of chronological time and chronological age. But a so-called epigenetic clock can measure biological age. And the epigenetic clocks already exist, reflect the pace of aging in humans. But in order to measure and test the effects of interventions in the lab, investigators have developed an age-predicting clock designed for studies, in this case, in mice. And the new clock accurately predicts mouse biological age and the effects of genetic and dietary factors, giving the scientific community a new tool to better understand aging and test new interventions. And the results will be published just this week in Cell Metabolism. So now that I am using something similar in a study coming up later in the spring or in the early summer that will show you how we age, we can slow down the aging. Now, we do have studies. In fact, I've done 43 clinical trials using only lifestyle behavior, and we have been able to substantially reverse markers of aging and the diseases of those markers of aging, like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, multiple sclerosis. And so more on this to come. There's a whole lot of new information on aging, and I'll be invited, I'm getting an invitation to present my latest research at an international conference on aging, and I'll go around, I'll meet with the other presenters, and I'll get all the information I can, then I'll share it with you all on an upcoming program, give you the latest cutting edge in the science of aging. I'm Gary Knoll, on the road, filming another documentary, helping some people reverse their aging process. In a moment, please stay with us. Right now, we can reasonably expect that all of the mainstream media and some of the alternative media will be hammering at the idea that we must save the citizens of Syria by intervening militarily. At the very least, we can cut the country in half and take many of the cities, and therefore we'll eliminate ISIS, and Assad won't be able to use chemical weapons again on his citizens. Well, there's several problems here. First, he never used, no proof whatsoever, he ever used sarin gas any point in the past. In fact, the United States was able to broker an agreement with Syria and Russia. Russia was really the ones who intervened, and all of their weapons they'd had from previous research was given the United States, and it was the United States that destroyed it. But there was a great deal of evidence presented as winning author Moore Hirsch that the rebel forces, though supported by the United States and Obama and the CIA, used the gas. And now we have a lot of evidence that we have presented exclusively on this program showing that the White Helmets are supporting terrorist groups, and it's all up front. They received $100 million from the United States and the CIA, and they're not the real defense forces. They're, you know, the rescuers. And they're involved in this last one, and I'll get to that. So we're going out now and saying, don't make any action against Syria, because Syria is winning. They are now ridding the country of terrorists, and they're a sovereign nation. Never a civil war. This was all a false flag operation from the beginning. So let's now back off. Unfortunately, the neocons, both the left and the right in Washington, and the Clintons, and the people surrounding Trump, remember, all the people surrounding Trump are, most of them are, have worked for the Trump, or excuse me, worked for the Koch brothers or their foundations at one point or another, or still do. They're pro-war. They want to see regime change. So here's what Ron Paul had to say about Syria and the gas attack.
Yesterday, there was some bombing with possibly gas exposure in Syria, and things have changed. It reminds me sort of weather reports. Well, if you don't like the weather, just wait an hour. You know, you'll get different weather. Well, that's sort of what happens in the Middle East sometimes. Yeah, just wait. It'll change. And actually, you know, before this episode of possible gas exposure and who did what, things were going along reasonably well for the conditions. You know, Trump says let the Syrians decide who should run their country. And peace talks were breaking out, and Al-Qaeda and ISIS were on the run, on maybe defeated. So it was like, you know, in spite of their problems with this foreign policy, it looked like there was some benefit. But it looks like maybe somebody didn't like that, so there had to be an episode. And the blame now is that we can't let that happen, because it looks like it might benefit Assad. So Assad, they claim, now went and released gas to kill a bunch of people. But, Daniel, we might not have much of a job here today, because I looked at the New York Times to find out, to get the explanation, and they said, worst chemical attack in years in Syria. U.S. blames Assad. So it's all over and done with. But not quite so easy, is it? What happened 4 years ago in 2013, you know, this whole thing about crossing the red line, and ever since then, the neocons have been yelling and screaming. Even part of the administration is still yelling and screaming about Assad using poison gases on his people 4 years ago. Not quite true.
Yeah, it was never proven, in fact. And the UN official Carlo Del Ponte said that attack was most likely done by the rebels, based on the evidence. But here you have Nikki Haley, U.S. ambassador to the UN, almost as we speak, literally, at the UN Security Council, saying, quote, "We know Assad has used chemical weapons before." It's not true. It has never been proven that he has. He may have. We do know that the rebels have used them. That has been proven.
And who would benefit? It makes no sense, even if you were totally separate from this and take no sides of this, and you were just an analyst. It doesn't make any sense for Assad in these conditions to all of a sudden use poison gases. I think it's zero chance that he would have done this, deliberately, and he's doing this now. But we could also go to a famous senator who's an expert on foreign policy, and we could go ask John McCain to explain it, and he found somebody to blame. And I don't know what he has it in for the president. We criticize our president once in a while, and we try to be, you know, balanced and criticize the things we think he's doing that we don't like. But McCain says, blame Trump. It's all Trump's fault because he hasn't been aggressive enough. He's backing off. He wants to have negotiations when you have to get rid of Assad. So he's back in prior to 2011 when the neocons, which are in cahoots with a few allies like Saudi Arabia and Israel, the Sunnis and the Iranians.
So there's one perspective. Unfortunately, it is not the perspective that will be adopted by the neocons, including the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post. I want to share a report from Beirut in Lebanon from Al-Mazdar News. And it says the following. At least 58 people were killed in a horrific gas attack governance this morning. However, even before the investigations could be conducted and for evidence to emerge, Federica, the Italian politician who is the high representative of the European Union for foreign affairs and security policy, condemned the Syrian government, stating that, quote, Assad regime bears responsibility for all Syrian chemical attack. The immediate accusation from a high-ranking European Union official serves a dangerous precedent where public outcry can be made even before the truth surrounding the tragedy can emerge. Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu joined in on the condemnation, as did Amnesty International. Merely hours after the alleged chemical weapons attack in the area, supposedly by the Syrian government, holes are beginning to emerge from the opposition sources, discrediting the Al-Qaeda-affiliated White Helmets' claims. Oh, well, hold on. You mean the White Helmets were giving information? Haven't they been substantially discredited as a terrorist group supported by the CIA? Yes, but the media is not covering that. For one, seen in a picture, the White Helmets are handling the corpses of people without sufficient safety gear, most particularly with the masks and also no gloves. Although this may seem insignificant, understanding the nation of sarin gas that the opposition claim was used only opens up questions. Within seconds of exposure to sarin, the effects of the gas begins to target the muscle and the nervous system. There is almost immediate release of the bowels and the bladder, and the vomiting is induced. When sarin is used in a concentrated area, it has the likelihood of killing thousands of people. Yet such a dangerous gas, and the White Helmets are treating bodies with little concern for their exposed skin. That raises a lot of questions. Then why aren't any of the White Helmets that are treating these people, are they showing any signs of exposure to sarin on themselves? It also raises the question why a so-called doctor, unidentified, in a hospital full of victims of gas, has the time to tweet and make video calls. It will probably be dismissed and forgotten, however. It is 250 people from two towns were kidnapped by Al-Qaeda terrorists last week. Locals and sources have claimed that many of those dead from the chemical weapons were those in the people who were captured by Al-Qaeda. Well, this would suggest that on the eve of upcoming negotiations, terrorist forces have once again created a false flag. This bears resemblance to the Ghouta chemical weapons 2013 that Ron Paul just referred to, where the Syrian army was accused of using the weapons of mass destruction on the day the United Nations weapons inspectors arrived in Damascus. Later, in a separate chemical weapon usage allegation, Carla Del Ponte, the UN weapons inspector, said that there was no evidence, zero, that the government had committed the atrocity. This had, however, not stopped the calls for intervention against the Syrian government. And by the way, just as an aside, How many times when you turn on Fox News and listen to the dunderheads talking, they all want war. It's as if they're all given a script, no matter who it is. When you go on television and we talk about Syria, always blame Assad for everything, and that we need more troops on the ground and we need to show them who's tough and we've got to protect their people. These people might be paid a lot of money, but there's not a journalist, in my opinion, amongst them, nor at the New York Times for that matter. They're not telling the truth. We, however, played you the tape of the real journalist from Canada who went into Mosul, who went into the war zone and reported the white helmets were fraud. They were terrorists. They were standing on bodies holding their AK-47s. Now, why didn't the New York Times, CNN, why didn't any other news organization, including Amy Goodman's Democracy Now, really smart woman, she managed to do something that the entire left has refused to wake up to, and that is she privatized and profited from her own asset, Democracy Now!, which was created by Samori Marksman, and she owns it. And not a peep from the left. So it's not surprising when someone wants to go after Assad in Syria on a so-called liberal station, a chance that it's a liberal foundation, it is not, and no one is called out for it. Well, we're calling people out for it. Do you have evidence from an American journalist on the ground who has firsthand eyewitness that it was the Syrian government that used the gas attack? If you do, present your evidence. Do you have firsthand witnesses that the white helmets are actually helping all people? We only see them with the same young girl in several different times. You mean the same young girl that they go from village to village and then rescue the same young girl in a different dress and sometimes the same dress and the same rubble, and no one gets this? Clearly, something's amiss here. So, therefore, we have to look at what's going on. And it is completely unsurprising that Orient TV has already prepared a media campaign to cover the Russia-Syria airstrikes in Hama countryside against terrorist forces with the allegation that the air forces have been using chemical weapons. In this program yesterday, we showed you eyewitnesses, researchers, human rights activists in the Gaza Strip showing that they were illegally using a weapon of mass destruction, white phosphorus. And by the way, the United States was using phosphorus in Iraq when they were going into a major city and killed tens of thousands of people. Not a single condemnation. So, and most telling, their announcement of covering the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government hours before the allegation even emerged. So let's see. Before the allegations, a news service already has that it's Syria who's responsible. That reminds me of Building 7 being, we were told in a report, and I saw it, I still have it on tape, the Building 7 has collapsed 20 minutes before it collapsed. Seems like someone forgot to tell him that it would not occur for a few more hours. So here's someone telling about the sarin gas explosion before it actually happens. Now, shouldn't even the dimmest-witted person, even an employee of the New York Times, should at least the managing editor, the editor-in-chief, some of the people won Pulitzers for doing softball reporting and never on a fight back? If someone puts out a news report that sarin gas attack has occurred, but they're 2 hours before the attack occurs, shouldn't that raise a question? Meanwhile, pickup trucks have been photographed around bodies of those killed. Again, it must be questioned why there are people around sarin gas with no production gear, affected at all by the gas, that would still be in the air within seconds of the attack. That's not humanly possible. As a scientist, I'm telling you, If you had a sarin gas attack and 10 seconds later you over the person's on the ground gasping, you're going to be equally impacted as that person. But they have all these pickup trucks there. And that's actually consistent. What the local people said was all those people who were dead or dying been kidnapped by Al-Qaeda terrorists from the towns nearby and then brought there. Also, what is brought into question is where the location of the hose is coming from in the picture, a dugout carved in the rock. And this also suggests that the location is at a white helmet space where there are dugout hiding spots carved into the mountainside and where they have easy access to equipment, as highlighted by Twitter user Ian Grant. And in response to the Syrian army, Arab army soldiers, northern Hama, denied the use of chemical weapons today, and this is consistent with the Russian Minister of Defense, who denied any involvement in the attack. So, in my personal opinion, there's only one reason for this, and it will spread, and that is because you have people surrounding the president who will now encourage him to show that he's really tough and go in there and start doing unilateral against Assad. And then to create a no-fly zone, and then to partition the country. And let Saudi Arabia and Turkey have control over that, and they in turn can allow their ISIS, al-Nusra, and al-Qaeda contingents to run it. And then suddenly we won't be thinking about terrorists in the Middle East, because that'll be a closed story. You don't have to have a very high IQ to see what's being done to you by the New York Times. I blame the New York Times. I hold them in contempt. And it's just unfortunate that a paper that was capable of doing honest reporting has succumbed to such demonstrably biased reporting. But so has the whole media. No wonder people don't trust them. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. I've asked my engineers in New York to get the clip up from the woman reporter, a true reporter, who went to Syria, went into zone, the only one I might mention, and saw the white helmets, saw the truth, saw the terrorists, saw who was stealing the food that was supposed to go to the people, and then came back and reported it. We are the program that had her on live to tell her story, and it's in our archives. But I'm going to see if we can't find it, and then we'll play it for you in a few moments. Now, I want to share a commentary written by Marjorie Cohen, a person I have a lot of respect for because Marjorie does good work. And this is from Truthout. And it's entitled Donald Trump's War Crimes. Just 2.5 months into his presidency, Donald Trump has already distinguished himself as a war criminal. His administration is killing unusually large numbers of civilians in violation of the U.S. and international law. The Trump administration began to kill civilians over inaugural weekend with 2 drone strikes in Yemen. 10 lives. One drone strike killed 3 people on a motorcycle. The other hit 7 people riding in a car. Neither Trump nor Defense Secretary James Mattis admits to having approved the strikes. It is not clear who authorized them. 1 week after inauguration, Trump bemoaned the death of a U.S. Navy SEAL in a bot raid he personally ordered in southern Yemen. Made no mention of the 30 people, including 10 women and children, killed by the U.S. bombers. The attack badly damaged a health facility and a mosque. Over the past month, the U.S.-led coalition has killed an inordinate amount of civilians. Quote, almost 1,000 non-combatant deaths have already been alleged from coalition actions across Iraq, Syria, and March. A record claim, according to Air Wars, a non-government organization that measures civilian casualties from airstrikes in the Middle East. Quote, these reported casualty levels are comparable with some of the worst periods of Russian activity in Syria. Air Wars says the United States aircraft have inflicted most of the casualties in the coalition strikes. Indeed, so many civilians have died from coalition airstrikes since Trump took office, Air Wars is reduced to work on alleged Russian actions in Syria so as best to focus on limited resources on continuing to properly monitor and assess reported casualties from the United States and its allies. Here they are. U.S. drones bombed a mosque in Aleppo, Syria, killed 47 people. U.S. aircraft bombed homes, a school, and a hospital in Syria, killing 20 civilians. U.S.-led coalition airstrike on a school that housed 50 families displaced by the fighting near a town in Syria killed 33 civilians. By the way, we're not even mentioning those who were severely injured and would die later or be permanently disabled. U.S. airstrikes in Mosul, Iraq, killed nearly 200 people, causing the largest loss of civilian life since the United States began bombing ISIS in Syria in 2014. And it was approved also by U.S. defense officials. And coalition airstrikes violate U.S. law. Quote, the Trump administration, like its two immediate predecessors, justified the use of armed drones and other forms of targeted killing with reference to the authorization for the use of military force that Congress passed just days after the December 11, 2001 attacks. And this authorization of use of military force, Congress authorized the president to use force against groups and countries that had supported the terrorist strikes, but Congress rejected the Bush administration's request for open-ended military authority, quote, to deter and preempt any further acts of terrorism or aggression against the United States. Deterrence and preemption are exactly what Trump is purportedly trying to accomplish by sending robots to kill suspected militants, those who happen to be present in an area where suspicion of activity has taken place. So, and she goes on to talk about how Trump is going to end up being probably the most killing president if he continues this pace in U.S. history since 9/11. And he's on a rip. You can expect anything from this guy. We found the clip. Let's go and hear a real journalist talk to you about the real white helmets and who they really are. Something that no other media, mainstream media, and even Democracy Now! Had on the documentary, people from the White Helmets praising them. We didn't. Listen in.
When you talk about the Syrian people and what the Syrian people want, how can you quantify that? Do you have any independent surveys where you can actually document that? And secondly, you talk about the corporate media, the Western media, the lies, and all of this. Could you explain what you think might be the agenda from us in the Western media, and why we should lie, why the international organizations on the ground should lie, why we shouldn't believe all these absolutely documentable facts that we see from the ground, these hospitals being bombed, these civilians who are talking about the atrocities that they have been experiencing. How can you justify calling all of us liars.
Sure.
Thank you.
I mean, there are certainly honest journalists amongst the very compromised establishment media. Let's start with your second question. So, international organizations on the ground. Tell me which ones are on the ground in Eastern Aleppo. Yeah, okay, I'll tell you, there are none. There are none. These organizations are relying on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry, UK, and which is one man. They're relying on compromised groups like the White Helmets, which, let's talk about the White Helmets. The White Helmets were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer. They have been funded to the tune of $100 million by the US, UK, and Europe and other states. They purport to be rescuing civilians in eastern Aleppo and Idlib, yet no one in eastern Aleppo has heard of them. And I say no one, bearing in mind that now 95% of these areas of eastern Aleppo are liberated. The White Helmets purport to be neutral, yet they can be found carrying guns and standing on the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. And their video footage actually contains children that have been recycled in different reports. So you can find a girl named Aya who turns up in a report in month, say, August, and she turns up in the next month in two different locations. So they are not credible. The SOHR is not credible. Unnamed activists are not credible. Once or twice, maybe, but every time, not credible. So your sources on the ground, you don't have them. As for your agenda, not your, but the agenda of some corporate media, it is the agenda of regime change. How can the New York Times, I was reading it this morning, or how can Democracy Now!, which I was reading the other day, maintain until this day that this is a civil war in Syria? How can they maintain until this day that that the protests were unarmed and nonviolent until, say, 2012? That is absolutely not true. How can they maintain that the Syrian government is attacking civilians in Aleppo when every person that's coming out of these areas occupied by terrorists is saying the opposite? How do I quantify the support of the Syrian people? The elections. In 2014, the Syrian people held elections. The point being, overwhelmingly, the people support President Assad. That's based on elections, based on my own travels. Okay, so that's subjective, but as I said, I've traveled around Syria, talked with people of all faiths, all walks of life, and there are people that want change in the government. We're not pretending they don't want change. Everybody wants change. But in terms of support of the government, the point is they don't see President Assad as the problem. They see the problem as terrorism. They see elements of problems in the system that they have there. But President Assad, they don't see as the problem. They actually overwhelmingly support him. So I'm basing it on their choice in their leader, and I'm basing it.
All right, there you have one Canadian journalist who was on the ground in the areas. No one else was there. She saw the truth of it. And she's telling the truth, yet you won't see her interviewed on any of the other media. Your thoughts on this, please. Talk back now. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Give us a call if you'd like to express your thoughts about how we go ahead with regime change. We do not look at the history. We do not want to have a real cause for interdicting ourselves within another country's life. We caused Al-Qaeda. We caused ISIS and Al-Nusra. We caused the blowback in the Middle East. We've taken no responsibility, and we continue on the same path, even more aggressively so, with the current president and his administration. So, give us a call if you have some thoughts on this. I'd like to hear from you. And there is a journalist, by the way, and she was all separate, heard, also in Aleppo. She was also going throughout Syria multiple times. And a panel of three people who had been telling their story. And if we in that clip, we'll play it for you as well. In the interim, this is from Jeffrey Sachs from the Boston Globe, and I want to share this with you, at least a little bit of it. It's entitled, U.S. Military Should Get Out of the Middle East. Quote, it's to end U.S. military engagements in the Middle East. Drones, special operations, CIA arms supplies, military advice, aerial bombings. the whole nine yards, over and done with. That might seem impossible in the face of ISIS terrorism, Iranian ballistic missiles, and other U.S. security interests. But a military withdrawal from is by far the safest path for the United States region. That approach has instructive historical precedents. America has been no different from other imperial powers in finding itself ensnared repeatedly in costly, bloody, and eventually futile overseas wars. From the Roman Empire till today, the issue is not whether an imperial army can defeat a local one. It usually can, just as the United States did quickly in Afghanistan in 2001 and Iraq in 2003. The issue is whether it gains anything by doing so. Following such a so-called victory, the imperial power faces unending heavy cost in terms of policing, political instability, guerrilla war, and terrorist blowback. Terrorism is a frequent consequence of imperial wars and imperial rule. Local populations are unable to defeat the imperial powers, so they impose high costs through terror instead. Consider the terrorism used by Jewish settlers against the British and local Palestinians in their fight for Israel's independence and territory, or Serbian terrorism deployed against the Habsburg Empire, or Vietnamese terrorism used against the French and the United States in Vietnam's long war for independence, or American terrorism, for that matter, that independence fighters used against the British and America's war of independence. This is, of course, not to condone terrorism. Indeed, my point is to condemn imperial rule and to argue for political solutions rather than imperial oppression, war, and the terror in its wake. Imperial rulers, whether the British and pre-independence America, the Americans in Cuba and the Philippines after 1898, the French and Americans in Vietnam, the United States in the Middle East in recent decades, foment violent reactions that destroy peace, prosperity, good governance, and hope. The real solutions to these conflicts lie in diplomacy and political justice, not in imperial rule, repression, and terror. So, and it goes on from there, but at least you get the idea. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.